palace gates, usually a mess of traffic. The only activity seems to be at the neighboring security center, now overrun with coalition soldiers. As we pass, they rip down the red, black, and silver banners, as well as the hung images of Maven Kalor. One by one, they set fire to the symbols. I watch his face burn, blue eyes locked on mine through a devouring tangle of red flame. The streets themselves are empty, and the fountain I remember, beautiful beneath a dome of crystal, is dry. War walks the stones of Harbor Bay. The palace gates are already open, yawning wide for Farley and me. We've been here before, as intruders, fugitives. Not today. When the transport slows, Farley is quick to clamber out, gesturing for me to follow. But I hesitate, still haunted by the events of the morning. It's only been a few hours since I watched Tiberius almost die. I can't get the sight out of my head. "Meh," she prods, her voice low. It's enough to snap me into action. The cerulean doors of the palace swing open on silent hinges, revealing two members of the Scarlet Guard keeping watch. Their ripped scarves are ruby bright, hopelessly out of place, and a sharp, unmistakable sign. We have returned here as conquerors. Ocean Hill still reeks of disuse and abandonment. I don't think Maven ever set foot inside once he became king. Corianne's faded golden colors hang from the walls and vaulted ceiling. It remains a tomb to a forgotten queen, empty but for her memory, and perhaps even her ghost. I see an odd reversal as I walk, noting the faces around me. A few Reds of the Scarlet Guard keep watch, their weapons openly displayed, but most seem without purpose. Recovering in the wake of battle, dozing against opulent columns, or lazily exploring the many salons and chambers branching off the central gallery. It's the Silvers who busy themselves with more menial work, probably on Annabelle's orders. They have to prepare Tiberius's new seat, his palace, to mark him as a legitimate ruler and king. They open windows, pull the covers from furniture, even dust off sills and statues. I blink at the sight, overwhelmed. Silvers doing housework. What a concept. The Red servants must have fled, and the Reds still here certainly won't do it for them. I don't recognize anyone in passing. No Julian, not even Annabelle supervising as her sworn soldiers prepare the palace. It worries me because there's only one other place they could be, and clearly they have to be there. I'm almost sprinting when Evangeline catches me, springing out from around a corner. Her armor is gone, discarded for lighter underclothes. If the battle was difficult for her, she certainly doesn't look it. While everyone else is dirty, if not still bloody, Evangeline Samos looks fresh from a cold bath. "Get out of my way," is all I can manage, trying to step around her. Farley halts, looking on with a glare. "Let her go, Samos," she snarls. Evangeline ignores her. Instead, she seizes my shoulders, forcing me to look her in the eye. I resist the familiar urge to deck her and instead let her look. To my surprise, she searches me over, eyes lingering on my many cuts and bruises. "You should see a healer first. We have plenty," she says. "You look horrible." "Evangeline," she sharpens. "He's fine. I promise you that." My eyes snap to hers. "I know that," I hiss. "I saw him with my own eyes." Even so, I clench my teeth at the memory, too fresh and still too painful. "He's alive. He survived her. The nymph princess," I remind myself. "His brother's deadly queen." I could wring his neck for doing it, challenging a nymph in the middle of the bay. I've seen Tiberius Kalor balk at swimming across a stream. He hates water, fears it like nothing else. It's the worst and easiest way for him to die. Evangeline bites her lip, watching me. She likes something in what she sees. When she speaks again, her voice has changed, softened. a featherlight whisper. I can't forget it. How he sank like a stone, armor and all, she says, moving close enough to speak in my ear. The words twist around me, prickling on my skin. How long was it until the healers got him breathing again? I squeeze my eyes shut, trying not to remember. I know what you're doing, Evangeline, and it's working. Tiberius, pale and dead, his body soaked through, mouth parted, eyes open and empty, unseeing. Shade's body was the same, and it haunts me still. When I open my eyes again, Tiberius's corpse is still there, hovering in my mind. I can't shake the sight. That's enough, Farley says, stepping bodily between us. She all but hauls me away, with Evangeline smirking. She falls into step behind us, prodding me in the right direction, like I'm a cow being led to pasture, or slaughter. I don't know Ocean Hill, but I know palaces well enough to know what I'm looking for. We climb a garish, winding stairwell to the residences, a floor dotted with royal chambers and apartments. Up here, away from the more public levels, the dust is worse than ever. It puffs up from the carpet in clouds. Corianne's colors are all over, gold and yellow, pale and worn, forgotten everywhere but here. I wonder if they bring her son pain, her son who almost joined her in death. The king's chambers are vast, opening off a guarded entry lined with Lariland soldiers. They share Annabelle's colors and her coloring. Black hair and bronze eyes. Tiberius's eyes. No one stops us as we pass, stepping into the sunken room now serving as a receiving chamber. A very crowded one. I see Julian first, his back to the arched windows, looking out on the now sparkling bay. It gleams blue in the afternoon sun. He angles his face to me, features pulling into an expression I can't name. Sarah Skonos stands at his side, her posture violently straight with her hands clasped in front of her. Though her hands are clean, the sleeves of her simple uniform are crusted to the elbows in both red and silver blood. I shudder at it. She doesn't notice me at first, focus on the mountainous man in the center of the room. He sinks to his knees. Farley quietly takes a seat, maneuvering herself in between a pair of Scarlet Guard lieutenants. She gestures for me to join her, but I stay put. I prefer the edges of this particular crowd. I've never officially met the ruling lord of House Rombos, but I recognize his bulk, even kneeling. His robes are unmistakable, resplendent in rich chocolate and crimson, edged with precious stones. He is their leader and the ruling governor of this city and region. His hair is dirty blonde, giving over to gray, braided back from his face in once intricate rows. They're coming undone, either from the battle or from the great lord pulling at his hair in desperation. I suppose both. Silvers are not accustomed to surrendering. I exhale and will myself to look up from Rombos's shoulders to the true king standing above him, sword in hand. The sight of him erases the corpse from my mind. His fingers hold firm, unwavering, his grip tight on the adorned hilt of the ceremonial blade. Where it came from? I don't know. It isn't the sword Alara made him kill his father with, but it looks close enough, and I'm sure he remembers it now, as he stands above another man begging for his life. It must pain him to do this to someone else, and of his own volition this time. Tiberius looks paler than usual, cheeks drained of color, but in shame or fear, I can't tell. Maybe it's exhaustion or pain. In spite of it, he is every inch a king. His armor cleaned, his crown donned. The angled lines of his jaw and cheekbones look sharper somehow, honed by the sudden weight on his shoulders. It's a mask, all of it. A brave face he must wear. His other hand is empty, fingers bare without flame. No fire but the one burning in his eyes. The city is yours, Rombos says, his head bowed and hands raised. Queen Annabelle steps close to her grandson's shoulder, fingers curled like talons. She might be the only person on Earth who can seem royal without her finery. "You will address him properly, Lord Rhombos." He is quick to acquiesce, dipping further, almost kissing his lips to the carpeted floor.
"Your Majesty, King Tiberius," he offers without hesitation.
He spreads his hands wide in open faith.
"The city of Harbor Bay and the entirety of the Beacon region is rightfully yours, returned to the true king of Norta."
Tiberius looks down his straight nose, turning the blade. The edge catches the light. The lord flinches, squinting against the sudden glare.
"And what of House Rhombos?"
he asks. "Next to me," Evangeline snorts into her hand. "What a performance."
"We are yours as well, to do with as you wish,"
the lord murmurs, his voice broken. For all he knows, Tiberius could execute his entire family, pull them out at the root, wipe their name and their blood from the face of the earth. Silver kings have done worse for less.
"Our soldiers, our money, our resources are at your disposal,"
he adds, listing off all his house can give. All his living house can give. A beat of silence stretches, taut as a pulled wire, threatening to snap apart. Tiberius surveys Lord Rhombos without blinking, without feeling, his face blank and unreadable. Then, he bears a smile. It bleeds warmth and understanding. I can't tell if it's real.
"I thank you for it," he says,
inclining his head a fraction. Beneath him, Lord Rhombos all but shudders in relief.
"Just as I will thank every member of your house when they follow your example and pledge an oath of loyalty to me, forsaking the false king who sits on my father's throne."
At his side, Annabelle beams. If she coached him, she did it well.
"Yes. Yes, of course,"
Rhombos stammers. He all but falls over himself to agree. I notice Tiberius edging his toes away, lest the fallen lord try to kiss them.
"That will be arranged as soon as possible. Our strength is yours."
Tiberius's face tightens.
"By tomorrow, my lord."
Leaving no room for argument.
"By tomorrow, your majesty,"
Rhombos replies, bobbing his head. Still kneeling, he clenches both meaty fists.
"All hail Tiberius the Seventh, King of Norta and true flame of the North,"
he shouts, his voice stronger by the second. The crowd of advisors and soldiers, both silver and red, responds in kind, repeating the obnoxious titles. A bit of color returns to Tiberius's cheeks as he flushes. His eyes dart back and forth, trying to note who cries his name and who doesn't. His eyes land on me and my unmoving lips. I hold his gaze, feeling a thrill as I keep my mouth resolutely shut. Farley does too, examining her nails instead of the unfolding pageantry. Annabelle basks in it, one hand on her grandson's shoulder. Her left hand, laid just so, to display an old wedding ring, set with a black gemstone. The only jewelry on her, and the only one she ever needs.
"All hail,"
she murmurs, her eyes shining as she looks up at Tiberius. At some flicker in his face, she springs into action, moving in front of him. She clasps her lethal hands together, rings still exposed.
"The king thanks you for your loyalty, as do I. We have much to discuss in the coming hours."
It's as good as a dismissal. Tiberius turns, putting his back to the room, and I realize what an admission it is. He's tired. He's wounded. Maybe not in body, but somewhere deep, where no one can see. The rigid set of his shoulders, his familiar posture, slumps beneath the ruby-red pauldrons of his armor, releasing some weight, or giving into it. Somehow all thoughts of his corpse come rushing back, Dread pools in me, threatening to fill me up and drag me down. I step forward, meaning to stay, but the crowd works against me, as does Evangeline. She takes me under my arm, her decorative claws still donned and digging into soft flesh. I grip my teeth, letting her lead me out of his chambers, not wanting to cause a fuss or a scene. Julian passes by us with a single raised eyebrow, surprised to see us in such close confidence. I try to communicate with my eyes, try to ask for some help or guidance, but he turns away before he knows what I want. Or he simply doesn't want to give it. We pass the guards again, the Larrylands looking like sentinels in their colors of red and orange. Perhaps that's where the robes first came from. I look back, over the heads of silver lords and red officers. Farley's blonde hair glints somewhere, with Ptolemy Samos keeping a safe distance from her. I see Annabelle, watching like a hawk. She plants herself in front of the door to Tiberius's bedchamber. He slips behind it, out of sight without so much as a backward glance. "Don't argue," Evangeline hisses in my ear. On instinct, I open my mouth to do just that. But I cut myself off as she drags me sideways, out of the crowd and into the corridor. Even though we're as safe as possible for the circumstances, my heart beats a ragged rhythm in my chest. "You said yourself locking us in a closet together wouldn't work." "I'm not locking anyone anywhere," she whispers back. "I'm just showing you the door." We turn and turn, taking the side stairs and servants' passages far too slowly and too quickly for my liking. My inner compass spins, and I think we're almost where we started when she halts within a dimly lit passage, almost too narrow for us to squeeze through. With a ripple of unease, I think of my earring, the one I'm not wearing. A blood-red stone, tucked away in a box in Montfort, hidden from the world. On my right, Evangeline lays her palm against an old door, rusted over from disuse. The hinges and lock have gone dark red, crusting like dried blood. With a flick of her fingers, the metal spins, shedding the rust like droplets of water. "This will take you—" "I know where it's going to take me," I reply, almost too fast. I suddenly feel like I've run a mile. Her grin sets me on edge and almost makes me turn around. Almost. "Very well," she says, taking a step back. Her hand brushes through the air, gesturing to the door like it's a priceless gift. "Instead of the naked manipulation it is. Do what you want, Lightning Girl. Go where you please. No one will stop you." I have no clever response for her. All I can do is watch her slink away, eager to be rid of me. Elaine must be on her way to the city to help celebrate this victory. I find myself envying them. They're on the same side, at least. Allied, despite the impossibilities stacked against them. Both silver, both raised noble. They know each other in a way Tiberius and I could never. They are the same. Equals. He and I are not. I should turn around. But I'm already through the door, pushing through the semi-darkness of a forgotten passage, my fingertips brushing along cool stone. A light bleeds ahead, closer than I thought it would be, outlining another door. Turn around. My hands flatten against the wood, a smooth cut, uniquely carved. I trace the panels for a moment, on edge. I know where this path leads, and who waits on the other side. Footsteps sound inside the room, making me jump as they pass. Then a chair creaks as a heavy weight sits. Two thumps announce his boots as he kicks them up on a desk or table. And then a long, lingering sigh. Not the satisfied kind. Full of frustration. Full of pain. Turn around. The knob moves in my hand as if of its own volition. And I step out, blinking into the soft light of afternoon. Tiberius's bedchamber here is large and airy, with vaulted ceilings painted blue and white, almost like clouds. The windows look out on the bay, and a sunnier day than it should be. The ocean breeze blows the last of the smoke away. It looks like the king is doing his best to fill the place with his usual mess, despite only having been here a few hours. He sits at a desk haphazardly dragged to the center of the room, angled away from a bed I refuse to even glance at. Papers and books pile around him. One in particular lies open, the text inside handwritten in a tight, looping scrawl. When I finally get the courage to look at him, Tiberius is already standing. He has a fist raised and flaming, his entire body coiled like a snake, ready to spring. His eyes rove over me, hands still ablaze, even though I'm not a threat. After a long moment, he brushes away the fire, letting it flicker and die.
"You got here in a hurry,"
Tiberius blurts out, almost breathless. It takes us both off guard, and he looks away, easing back into his desk chair. He puts his back to me and quickly shuts the book with one hand. It spits dust. The cover is worn, a faded gold, with no writing on it and a broken binding. He shoves it away, tucking it into a drawer with little regard. Then he pretends to busy himself with some reports. He even bends over them with a very obvious squint. I smirk to myself and take a step toward him. Turn around. Another step into the room. The air seems to vibrate on my skin. After the... I stumble. There's no easy way to say it. After. I had to see for myself, I reply, watching the side of his mouth lift. His eyes don't move, burning a hole into the page in front of him. And? Shrugging, I rest my hands on my hips. You're fine. I shouldn't have bothered. At the desk, he barks out a harsh but genuine laugh. Tiberius leans backward, putting an arm over his chair, twisting to look at me fully. In the daylight, his bronze eyes gleam like molten metal. They run over me, snagging on the exposed cuts and bruises. His gaze feels like fingers.
What about you?
He asks, his voice lower. I hesitate a little. My own injuries seem small compared to what he suffered, and to the memory of Killorn choking on his own blood. Nothing that can't be mended. He purses his lips.
That's not what I asked.
Nothing to compare, I mean, I tell him, circling to the front of his desk. He moves with me, tracking like a hunter. It feels similar to a dance or a pursuit. Not all of us can say we almost died today.
Oh, that.
He mutters and runs a hand through his hair. The short locks stand on end, mussing an otherwise kingly appearance.
Everything went to plan.
I scowl, showing my teeth. Funny, I don't remember fighting a killer nymph in the middle of the ocean being part of the plan. He adjusts in his chair, uncomfortable. Slowly, he starts discarding his armor, revealing the thin, tight shirt and trimmer form beneath. It's a dare, but I hold my ground. Each piece hits the floor with a resounding clatter.
We needed the ships. We needed the harbor.
I keep circling, and he keeps tossing pieces of armor away. He unfastens his gauntlets with his teeth, never taking his eyes off me.
And we needed you to go toe-to-toe with her? Who had the advantage there,
Tiberius? The king smirks against red steel.
I'm still alive.
That isn't funny. Something tightens in my chest. I run a finger down the adorned edge of his desk, swiping at the dusty surface. My skin comes away, gray, leached of warmth, like it was when I masqueraded as a silver, suffering through painted-on makeup just to keep breathing.
We almost lost Killorn today.
Tiberius's smirk drops instantly, wiped away, and he forgets the armor for a moment. Darkness clouds his eyes, dulling their gleam.
I thought Newtown fell easily. They didn't expect...
He cuts himself off, clenching his teeth. I look away as his gaze lands on me.
I don't want to see his pity. What happened?
My breath feels ragged in my throat. It feels too close to relive. The danger's still near. Silver guards, I mumble. A Telki. Tossed him down a stairwell. Tore up his insides. The words hitch as the memory reigns. My oldest friend. His skin going pale. Dying faster by the second. Red blood on his chin. His chest. His clothes. All over my hands. The king doesn't say anything, holding his tongue. With a great burst of will, I look back at his face to find him staring, eyes wide, lips pressed into a grim, thin line. The concern is clearly written on him, in his furrowed brow and tight jaw. I force myself to move again, my path taking me back around. Closer to his chair, into the circle of familiar heat. We got him to a healer in time. I say as I walk, he'll be all right, same as you. When I pass behind him, I bite back the urge to touch his shoulders, to put one hand on either side of his neck and lean forward, bracing myself against him, letting him hold me up. Now more than ever, the need to let go and rest, to allow someone else to carry my burdens, is difficult to resist. But you're here with me. He whispers so low I almost don't catch it. Instead, the words linger. Smoke between us. I have no answer for him. None I'm willing to give or admit. I'm no stranger to shame. I certainly feel it now, as I stand in his bedchamber, with Killorn recovering miles away. Killorn, who wouldn't be here if not for me. It isn't your fault. Tiberius pushes on. He knows me well enough to guess my thoughts. What happens to him isn't on your shoulders. He makes his own choices. And without you, what you did for him? His voice trails off. You know where he would have ended up. Conscripted. Doomed to a trench or a barracks. Probably dead in the final gasps of the Lakelander Boar. Another name on a list. Another red lost to silver greed. Another person forgotten. Because of people like you, I think, forcing a deep breath. The bedroom smells like salt air, fresh from the open windows. I try to take some comfort in what he says, but I can't. It doesn't excuse anything I've done, or what Killorn has become because of me. Though I suppose we've all changed since last year. Since that day when his master died, and he stood in the dark beneath my house, trying not to mourn his life as it was snatched away. I swallow hard, remembering what I said. Leave everything to me. I wonder if we changed into who we were supposed to become, or if those people are gone forever. I guess only John would know, and the seer is long gone, far out of reach. Clearing my throat, I change the subject with little tact. I hear there's a Lakelander fleet on the horizon. I put my back to him, turning to face the exterior door, the one leading back into his receiving chamber. I could walk out right now if I wanted. He wouldn't stop me. I'm just stopping myself with every single breath. I hear that too, Tiberius replies. Then his voice drops, deepening. It wavers in fear. I remember darkness. Emptiness. Nothing. Reluctantly, I look over my shoulder to watch him stand, shedding the last of his armor, avoiding my gaze. He's still tall, still broad, but lesser, without the weight of the battle-worn steel. Younger looking, too, just 20 years old. Tipping on the edge of manhood, parts of him still clinging to youth, holding on to something as it disappears, just like the rest of us. I went into the water, and I couldn't get back up. He kicks the pile of steel on the floor. Couldn't swim. Couldn't breathe. Couldn't think. I feel like I can't breathe either. Tiberius shudders as I watch, a tremor that starts in his fingers. His fear is terrifying. Then he forces himself to look back at me. With his feet planted and his hands firmly settled on his hips, he is rooted. The king won't move unless I do. He's going to make me surrender first. It's what any good soldier would do. Or he is simply letting me choose, letting me decide for both of us. He probably thinks it's the honorable thing to do.
I thought of you before the end,
he says.
I saw your face in the water.
And I see his corpse again, suspended before me, dappled by the shifting light of a churning sea, afloat at the mercy of a foreign tide. Neither of us moves.
I can't,
I bite out, looking anywhere but his face. He responds quickly with force.
Neither can I.
But I also can't stay away, keep doing this, denying ourselves in the face of always looming death. Tiberius hisses out a breath.
Neither can I.
When we take the step forward together, from opposite directions, both of us laugh. It almost breaks the spell. But we keep walking, equal in motion and intention, slow and methodic, measuring. He watches me, I watch him, as the space closes between us. I touch him first, putting my palm flat over his thudding heart. He inhales slowly, his chest rising beneath my fingers. A warm hand slips around my back, splaying wide over the base of my spine. I know he can feel my old scars through my shirt, the knobbled skin familiar to us both. I answer by curling my other hand at the nape of his neck, gently digging my nails into the lock of black hair. This doesn't change anything, I say, against his collarbone, a firm line against my cheek. I feel his answer in my ribcage.
No.
We aren't making different decisions. His arms tighten around me.
No.
So what is this, Cal? The name has an effect on us both. He shivers and I move closer, flattening against him. It feels like giving in. For both of us, though we have nothing left to surrender.
We're choosing not to choose.
That doesn't sound real.
Maybe it isn't.
But he's wrong. I can't think of anything more real than the feel of him. The heat, the smell, the taste. It's the only real thing in my world. This is the last time, I whisper before I cover his mouth with mine. Over the next few hours, I say that so many times, I lose count.
21. Maven. I hate the waves. They offend me. Every heave of blue against the hull of the boat makes my stomach toss, and it is entirely too difficult to remain still, silent, the image of reserved strength I need to be. Perhaps Iris or her mother is roiling the sea on purpose, in punishment for my risking Iris's life in Harbor Bay. Even though she survived and escaped easily enough. Survived, escaped, and lost the city to my perfect brother. I wouldn't put it past the Lakelander Queen. She's even more powerful than her daughter. Certainly she can control the rise and fall of the ocean around us. I spot her ships ahead, 6 of them. Small but formidable warships. Less of her armada than we expected. I snarl to myself, lip curling. Can no one simply do as they're told? Even with her daughter in the balance, leading the failed defense of the city, Queen Senra hasn't brought her full strength. A trickle of heat bursts through me, a tongue of angry fire down my spine. I restrain it quickly. The constant motion makes it more difficult to keep my grip on the rail of the deck. It drains my focus. And when I lose focus, my head becomes less quiet. Harbor Bay is gone. Another thing lost to Cal, the familiar voice whispers. Another failure, Maven. Mother's voice has grown fainter as time passes, but she never truly recedes. Sometimes I wonder if she planted a seed in me, leaving it to bloom only after her death. I don't know if whispers can even do that. But it's an easy explanation for the murmurs and the mutters that rattle around in my skull. Sometimes I'm glad for her voice, her guidance from beyond the grave. The advice is always small. Sometimes it's something she used to say before she died. Sometimes it could be just memories. But I wake up far too often from uneasy sleep, her words ringing in my ears, for her voice to simply be a product of my own mind. She's here with me still, whether I want her to be or not. I call it a comfort, even when she is anything but. "All that matters is the throne," she whispers again, as she whispered over the years. Her voice is almost lost to the swell of the ocean. Part of me strains to hear, and part of me tries not to listen. "And what you have given to get it." That is today's refrain. It repeats as my flagship sails toward the waiting armada, cutting through the waves as the sun sets low and red against the distant coast. Harbor Bay still trails smoke, teasing me on the horizon. At least her voice is gentle today. When I falter, when I slow down, it turns sharp, a fraying, splintering shriek, steel on steel, glass popping in the heat of flame. Sometimes it's so awful I check to make sure my eyes and ears aren't bleeding. They never do. Her words never exist beyond the cage of my head. I stare at the waves ahead, each one a white crest of foam, and think of the path laid out. Not before, but behind. How I came to stand on the prow of a ship, a crown low across my forehead, with the spray of salt water drying on my skin. What I gave to be here. The people I left behind, willingly or not. Dead or abandoned or betrayed. The terrible things I've done and let be done in my name. How much will have been in vain if I fail. And now I race toward a Lakelander fleet. Enemies turned allies through my own careful maneuvering. Like the rest of my country, I was taught to hate the Lakelands, to curse their greed. Perhaps more than anyone else, I learned to despise them. After all, my own father and his father spent their lives locked in a stalemate war on the northern border. They saw thousands wasted against the blue uniforms, drowned in the lakes, obliterated by minefield and missile. Of course, they knew what the war was truly for. I don't know if Cal, the poor, simple brute, ever connected such easily traced dots. But I certainly did. Our war with the Lakelands served a purpose. Reds outnumber us. Reds can overthrow us. But not if they die in greater numbers than we do. And not if they fear something else more than they fear the Silvers standing over them. Be it dying in war, or just the Lakelanders, anyone can be manipulated against their own interests if given the right circumstance. My ancestors knew that well enough. And their deepest hearts. To maintain power, they lied, they manipulated, they spilled blood. Just not their own. They sacrificed life, but not the lives closest to them. I can't say the same. Mother is never far from my thoughts, not just because of her voice running through my mind, but simply because I miss her. The ache is permanent, I think. A dull pain that dogs my every step, like a missing finger or a shortness of breath. Nothing has ever been the same since she died. I remember it, the sight of her brutalized corpse in that red girl's hands. The memory is a punch in the gut. It isn't the same with Father. I saw his corpse too, but felt nothing for it. Not anger, not sadness, just emptiness. If I ever loved him, I have no memory of it. And searching for one only gives me a headache. Of course, Mother removed it. To protect me, she said, from a man who did not love me as he loved her rival son, my older brother. The perfect boy in all things. That love for Cal is gone too. But sometimes I feel its ghost. Moments return at the oddest times, drawn out by a smell or a sound or a word spoken a certain way. Cal loved me, I know that, of course. He proved it many times over many years. Mother had to be more careful with him, but in the end it wasn't she who severed the last thread between us. It was Mare Barrow. My brilliant fool of a brother couldn't keep side on all that was his, and what little was mine. I remember the first time I watched the security footage of them together, dancing in her forgotten room tucked away in the summer palace. It was Cal's idea, their meetings, their dance lessons. Mother sat by my side, near enough if I needed her. I reacted as she trained me to, without feeling, without even blinking. He kissed her like he didn't know or didn't care what she meant to anyone but himself. "Because Cal is selfish," Mother croons in the memory and in my mind, her voice like silk and like a razor. The words are familiar, another old refrain. "Cal sees only what he can win and what he can take. He thinks he owns the world. And one day, if you let him, he will. What will that leave for you, Maven Kalor? The scraps? The leftovers? Or nothing at all?" My brother and I have something in common, at least. We both want the crown, and we're both willing to sacrifice anything to have it. At least I, in my worst moments, when the wretchedness threatens to overwhelm me, can blame such wanting on my mother. But who can he blame? And somehow everyone calls me the monster. I'm not surprised by it. Cal walks in a light I'll never find. Iris is always going on and on about her gods, and sometimes I believe they must be real. How else is my brother still living, still smiling, still a constant threat to me? He must be blessed by someone or something. My only consolation is knowing I'm right about him, and always will be. Right about Mare, too. I poisoned her enough, tainted her enough. She'll never tolerate another king. Not for any amount of love. And Cal has discovered that firsthand. Another gift of mine across the miles between us. I only wish I'd figured out a way to keep that strange new blood, the one who bridged a connection between Mare and me. But the risk was too great, the reward too small. An obliterated base for the chance to speak with her again? It was a foolish trade, and even for her, I wouldn't make it. But I wish I could. She's out there across the waves, somewhere in the city along the distant crimson coast. Alive, obviously. Or else we would know it. Even though it's only been a few hours, the death of the Lightning Girl would not be a secret for long. The same goes for my brother. They survived. The thought makes my head pound. Harbor Bay was a logical choice for Cal. But the Red Tech slum was obviously Mare's own brainchild. She is so married to her cause, in all her red-blooded pride. I should have predicted she would go after Newtown. It's sad, really, to know that her cause relies on people like Cal, his sneering grandmother, and the Samos traitors. None of them will give her what she wants. It will only end in bloodshed, and probably her own death when all is done. If only I had kept her closer. A better guard, a tighter leash. Where would we be now? And where would I be if Mother could have removed her from me, as she removed Father and Cal? I can't say. I don't know. It hurts my head to wonder. I look down the deck at the soldiers manning the ship. She might have been beside me, if not for a few missteps. The wind in her hair. Her eyes shadowed and sunken, wasted by the manacles keeping her tethered to me. An ugly sight, but still beautiful. At the very least, she is still alive. Her heart still beats. Not like Thomas. I wince as his name crosses my thoughts. Mother couldn't remove him either. not the agony of his loss, nor the memory of his love. That future is gone, killed, chased out of existence. A dead future, that horrible new blood seer used to call it. I think John was my tormentor more than I was his jailer. Clearly, he could have left whenever he wanted, and whatever he accomplished in my palace is still budding fruit. Again, I look out to the water, to the east this time, over a vast and endless ocean. The emptiness should calm me, but two early stars hang above the waves. The bright, cheerful lights offend me, too. Queen Senra's ship is easy to spot as we sail closer. The waves beside it are calm, almost still, a flat quelling of water. Her ship hardly rocks, even this far from land. The Lakelander ships aren't as sleek as ours. Our manufacturing capabilities are better than those in the Lakelands, thanks in very large part to the tech slums that Mare is intent on destroying. Even with her ships and my own, our guns are few, and anything we might use against the city will certainly meet resistance from Magnetrons and New Bloods, if not my foul brother himself. Only the Harbor Bay battleship, Iris's for now, has any kind of artillery that could be of use this far out. I glare at it, the steel craft anchored alongside Senra's ship. It casts a long, jagged shadow, planted firmly between the Lakelander Queen and the coast. My scheming queen is using it as a shield, a very expensive shield. I growl to myself as I board her ship, careful to keep my feet when I step from one deck to the next. My own sentinels flank me as we walk, too close for comfort. I keep my hands at my sides, ungloved, fingers bare in threat.
"This way, Your Majesty," a single Lakelander says, beckoning from an open door bolted with rivets and a wheel lock. "The queens are waiting."
"Tell them the king waits on deck," I reply, turning aside to walk the edge of the ship. This isn't a pleasure cruise, and there aren't many places to stand, let alone congregate. But I'd rather stay on deck than go below, to be trapped behind steel with a pair of nymphs. My sentinels walk ahead of me, careful to keep in formation, as we climb a set of stairs to a landing overlooking the prow. It doesn't take the queens long to appear, moving in tandem. Senra wears a flowing uniform, dark blue with silver and gold chasing. A black sash divides her body from shoulder to hip, clasped in precious sapphire. In mourning still. I don't think Mother wore her mourning clothes for more than a few days. Perhaps the Lakelander Queen cared for her husband. How strange. She watches me, storm-eyed, her skin a cold bronze washed gold by the setting sun. I feel as if I can read the battle on Iris. Her blue sleeves are charred to the elbow, the threads stained in two kinds of blood, and her long black hair is undone, still wet, brushed over one shoulder. A healer trails her, tentatively working on Iris's arms as she walks, smoothing away burns and cuts. Keeping her at an arm's length has been a wise decision. I want little to do with my wife, who would probably prefer to kill me. But like Red's, she can be controlled by fear and need. She has both in equal measure. So does Senra. It's why she dared to leave her borders. She knows I hold her daughter in the palm of my hand. I don't doubt she wants to extricate Iris from our marriage. But she needs this alliance as much as I do. Without me, she faces Cal and his band of traitors and criminals, a united front against her. I'm her shield, as she is mine. "My queens," I say, bowing slightly to them both as they approach. Her daughter looks more like a soldier than a queen maid and princess born. The queen of the Lakelands dips into a shallow curtsy. Her sleeves brush the deck. "Your Majesty," she replies. I turn my face to the horizon. Harbor Bay has fallen.
For now, Senra says, her voice offensively calm. Oh, I sneer, raising an eyebrow. You think we can win it back? Tonight, perhaps? Again, she dips her head. In time. I finish for her. When the rest of your armada arrives. Queen Senra grits her teeth. Yes, of course, she reluctantly grinds out. But, I ask. The sea air feels cold on my bared teeth. We do have our own shores to guard, she says. At her side, Iris looks smug, glad to let her mother fight this battle. The lakes must remain defended, especially from Montfort. They can cross prairie and strike our western border easily, as can the kingdom of the Rift on our east. I have to laugh. Sneering, I wave a hand at the horizon. Full of Samos traitors and Montfort usurpers, all beneath my brother's idiot command. Strike your border with what army? The one currently occupying my city? Senra flares her nostrils and a flush heats her face, dusting over her cliff-like cheekbones. Samos has the Norton Air Fleet, one of the biggest on the continent. Not to mention Montfort's own capabilities, whatever they are. Your brother has the advantage from the air, and he has the speed. Anywhere could be at risk of attack. She speaks slowly, as if I am a child who needs his hand held through war. It tingles my fingers. That cannot be ignored, Your Majesty. As if on wretched cue, a battalion of air jets races over the coast in formation. The distant scream of them reaches us slowly, a dull and stretching roar. I fold my arms over my chest, tucking away my hands lest they ignite. Bracken's air fleet should be enough to hold them off, I mutter, keeping my eyes on the jets as they move, circling the city. Protective maneuvers. Iris finally finds her voice.
The bulk of his fleet was cannibalized by the Montfort occupation. They can't match what we're up against.
She clearly delights in correcting me. I let her take this small comfort instead of losing my temper.
To look powerful is to be powerful.
Mother said that too many times to count.
Look calm, still, strong, assured of yourself and your victory.
Which is why we have to return to a place of strength, Senra says. We're no good out here on the waves, waiting to be picked off from the sky.
Even the nymphs of Signetline are not invincible.
Of course they aren't, you proud nit. Instead, I blink at her, trying to burn through her with my eyes. You suggest a retreat.
We've already retreated,
Iris snaps. The healer at her side steps back a little, cowed by her anger.
Harbor Bay is one city.
I clench a fist and a burst of heat ripples on the air. Harbor Bay is not the only piece of my country lost to my brother, I say quietly, slowly. Low enough that they must strain to hear. The south is his. The Rift and Delphi. He took Corvium from me. And now he has Fort Patriot, too. My sneering queen doesn't quell against my checked fury.
Fort Patriot will be of little use to them for a long time, she says,
looking like a satisfied cat after a particularly big dinner. Oh, I reply. And why is that? She glances sidelong at her mother, sharing a look I cannot decipher.
When it became clear the city was lost, and that Tiberius would win the day, I flooded the fort as much as I could,
Iris explains, proud and still.
The seawall came down. Half of it is underwater, and the rest is cut off from land. I would have sunk the battleships if I could, but the escape took too much out of me. Still, the repairs will slow them down, and I've taken valuable resources from their effort.
And from me? Even if we win back the city now, the fort is destroyed. What a waste. Jets, The war port docks, arms and ammunition, simple infrastructure. I hold her gaze, letting a bit of my mask slip, letting her know that I realize what she's doing. Iris and her mother will incapacitate me little by little, cutting me off from my own resources. The nymph queens are cunning. They don't have to put me in the water to drown me. It's simply a question of how long that will take, and how to balance their actions against my own. They're letting Cal and me waste ourselves on each other, hoping to face the wounded victor in later days. Iris stares back at me, her eyes tipping like a scale. She is cold and calculating, still water hiding a riptide.
"So we return to Archeon," she replies. "Gather the full mass of our strength, everyone that can be spared. Bring the full fury of this war to bear on their heads."
I lean back against the rail of the ship, exuding an appearance of calm detachment. Sighing, I glance at the waves as they stain red with sunset. "We'll move tomorrow."
"Tomorrow?" Senra balks. "We should go now."
Slowly I grin, careful to show my canines. The kind of smile that sets people off balance. I have a feeling my brother will be sending us a message soon.
"What are you talking about?" Senra murmurs.
I offer no explanation and look out to the east instead. On the darkening horizon, smudges stand out against the stark line of the sea. "The islands will be neutral ground," I muse.
"Neutral ground," Senra repeats, turning the words over in her mouth.
Iris says nothing, but her eyes narrow to slits. I drum my fingers against my chest, huffing out a low breath. What a joyous reunion this will be. I can only imagine it. A rainbow of scowling backstabbers and betrayers seated across from us, ready to preach and preen. Evangeline, with her claws and her put-upon arrogance. That Red General Farley, who will bleed for all she's done to my kingdom. Moping, methodic Julian, trailing my brother like a forgotten ghost. Our own grandmother Annabelle, another person who was supposed to love me and never did. The Montfort leader, still a mystery and a danger. Of course Mare will be there, a storm in her skin. And my brother, too. It's been a long time since I've looked into Cal's eyes. I wonder if they've changed. For I certainly have. Will we make terms? I very much doubt it. But I want to see them again, both of them. At least once more before this war is done, ended in whatever fate. Their deaths or mine. Neither future frightens me. My only fear now is losing the throne, the crown, the reason for all this misery and torment. I won't destroy myself in vain. I won't let this all be for nothing.
22. Iris. When Maven returns to his own ship, I fear he might force me to go with him and deny me a few more hours with my mother. To my surprise, his petty rage and his political cunning do not extend so far. We are left alone on Mother's flagship once more, given over to our own devices. With room to talk at length and time to plan. Either he doesn't see us as a threat, or he doesn't care to fear us. I would venture the latter. He has more immediate enemies right now, and can spare a little thought for his own wife. The Swan is a warship, built for battle and speed. What pass for staterooms are spare and rigid, barely suited to red servants. Still, Mother looks at home in them, equally at ease upon a bolted-down narrow bed as on a jeweled throne. She isn't a vain woman and carries none of the flawed materialistic pride most Silvers have. That was Father's domain. He preferred his finery, even on the battlefield. The thought sends a sharp stab of pain through me as I remember the last time I saw him alive. He was dashing in his armor, blue steel studded with sapphires, gray hair pulled back from his face, I suppose Salan Iral found some flaw and exploited it well. I paced to settle myself, moving back.